since we're being recorded, probably the first thing to start with is to go around the table and introduce ourselves and identify your connection with the constituency or stakeholder group, as the case may be.
Andrei Kolesnikov, non-voting member, PNSO.
This is Leslie from Seoul Fellowship, and I'm also the member of NTUC.
And the Chinese trademark attorney. This is Kathy Kleiman, non-commercial users constituency.
Konstantinos Komaitis with NCSG.
Yes, my name is Robin Gross, and I'm the chair of NCUC, also a member of NCSG.
Mary Wong, counselor for the NCSG, here as an observer.
Mark Partridge with ESG and IPC.
Mr. Vini, vice chair of the RSG, here as an observer and substitute alternate.
Marika Konings, Icon Staff.
John Nevitt, Registrar Constituency.
Stakeholder Group, right?
Yeah.
Jeff Newman, Registry Stakeholder Group.
David Maher, newly elected chair of this group and chair of the Registry Stakeholder Group.
Paul McGrady with the IPC and the CS.
Olivier Crépin-Leblon, alternate at-large.
Alan Greenberg, at-large. Zahid Jamil, BC, CSG.
Liz Gaster, ICANN Policy Staff.
Thank you, Kat.
I wanted to ask you, David, I may have spoken too quickly. What were you thinking of if we go more informal than submitting statements? That's obviously something you gave some thought to. So what were you thinking of as another way of presenting here?
Well, it was not a fully formed thought. It was just an attempt to get the ball rolling, as to get the sense of the group as to whether there would be enough consensus already to move forward. I realize now it was premature. So. Some housekeeping questions. Go ahead.
Just to follow up on what Kathy was saying, I think as far as the BC is concerned, we have a position that we'll be sending out in a few days as well. But I was hoping that maybe we could use this very rare face-to-face meeting opportunity we have to go a little dig deeper into some of the substantive stuff today as well. Because I think we have common ground in many things.
Yeah.
Alan Greenberg, two issues. Number one, I think we have to come out of this meeting knowing what the process is that we're going to follow for the rest of the month. The second is, I note on rereading the motion that we have about 4 weeks to solve all of the world's problems, and then council has 2 weeks to think about the answer. I would suspect that we should go back and ask council to put our deadline somewhere around the end of the first week in December and give us another week and a half or so, and then give them a week to decide, as opposed to us trying to do it in a too short time and then having them think.
Well, I agree with you that the time period is ridiculously short. I'd rather put off asking for an extension until it's absolutely necessary. I'm optimistic enough, which was really the source of my original comment, that we're really all not that far apart, but let's see the way it works. A housekeeping question. For one thing, I don't believe I have a list of the members of this group. Has one been circulated?
I don't think yet. I did ask Len, I think she just set out, if such a list was already available, so I'll follow up on that with her.
Some housekeeping members. So once we have a list, well, it seems like the list already online is a little broader. So who will have access to participate in the list, and Is it limited to just the appointed members or not? And will we use a similar system that we do with council where all the emails will be transparent, but only the councilors will be able to use the actually send the emails?
Yeah, well, that was my next question was, do we have an email list existing or about to get one?
This list is already in existence and is being archived, but I'm not sure whether indeed other members that initially signed up before this group decided to, you know, have a restricted number of representatives from each stakeholder group constituency, whether others have been removed or whether they are still on the list and can receive the emails but just not post. So I will follow up on that and get back to you on that.
David, Chuck Gomes, the chair of the GNSO Council. The one of the decisions you probably want to make is this list was set up for the drafting team that met on Saturday. So a decision you probably need to make, does that list need to be reformulated to include just this group, or are you comfortable with those other people being on this and any of it need to be added? I'm not suggesting one way or the other, but that's something you need to decide. I do appreciate the fact that you did not jump to extending the time period right now, because it's the board deadline that we're working towards, and the council will need some, I mean, 1 week for the council to go out and get feedback from each stakeholder group in the council and the other groups associated with the council isn't going to cut it. I know it's short. If you get to a point, you know, where it's just impossible, we can go forward and ask. I'm not sure how receptive they will be, especially when I heard today they're not even planning on a comment period. The board's not. You were in the session this morning. So try to meet the deadline, and I want to give you one more point of information that just happened in the council follow-up session that happened from 1 to 3. Our late November meeting, which the motion references, is going to occur on the 23rd of November. So if, you know, as much information that you have at that point in time would be very helpful. I didn't say you have to be totally finished, but it would be very helpful to counsel, and that will facilitate the process of review, even if it's a partial review at that time.
I just to clarify, the only message that I have that is really specifically about this group is from Glenn on Saturday, addressed to Robin, me, Stephen Talitz, Phil Shepard, Zahid. Yeah, apparently I'm not on the list.
So we'll make sure to add you. Are there any other members of the team that are not on the mailing list?
In that case, David, I apologize because I thought you saw the nomination in seconds on that list.
No. Surprise, surprise. That was very cleverly done.
I nominated you. Mr. Jamil seconded it, and John Nevitt seconded it again, second time, just so you know who to blame.
Okay, well, if we can get a list of the member or a mailing list and a list of the members, that would be fine.
This is Marika again. Just a question. So, if I confirm who's on the mailing list, would you like to restrict it to those members that are part of the team? And we just send a note to the other site, you know, here's the link of the archives. You can go and look at it there. Is everyone happy with
I
that?
I think it's a consensus, but restrict it.
Okay.
Okay. Then we've agreed, I believe, that we'll follow the schedule set forth in the motion that each of stakeholder groups will solicit from their members the initial position statements on the questions and issues raised and the staff proposed models, and will deliver the initial position statements on November 4, and that delivery, I assume, will be by email. I have one other question to raise, and that is the WIPO position. If anyone has that readily available, I'd appreciate having it sent to me. Is everybody familiar with the WIPO, the alternative proposal related to the IRT, or the comments on the IRT proposal.
Mark, WIPO has issued statements for their own proposal for a rapid suspension process and for a post-delegation. And they've also commented on the IRT report. But I think what you'd be referring to, David, would be their particular proposal.
Yeah, I was thinking that that might be helpful.
Yeah, so they have specific proposals on those two aspects of what, well, the only aspect that's before us is the URS, because the post-delegation isn't part of this process.
Right.
So
and
they do have that one, and I guess it would make sense for that to be in the mix.
They did not comment on the database list.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I think you do need to look at their comments. All right, this is Jeff Newman. You do need to look at their comments to the final IRT report. But I think that's what Yunju was quoting yesterday during the trademark session.
Marika, if she can, if somebody can give it to her, she can circle it to the list. Everybody will get a copy. I mean,
and there are also many references to the nominet rapid suspension. Does anybody have access to that, and could that be?
John, there was a gentleman who came to the New York consultation and did a proposal, and I mean, I think he discussed the San Francisco. Yeah, it was San Francisco, rather. Sorry, at the IRT meeting, and he had a deck, so maybe we could track that down and circulate that.
There might be a link to the, in one of the documents to the short answer. We'll try to find it, and
Margie will have it.
Yeah.
Okay. Since we're all assembled here, it would be a good idea to use the time constructively. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was going to ask a real stupid question. So I know obviously the 8 questions that the board asked on the clearinghouse. But I can't quite figure out what they want our constituency to comment on with respect to the URS. So does anyone have an idea of exactly what the board wants to hear from us on that? Does anybody know? I mean, it says, just to go into it, it says the GNSO Council by consensus can either A, approve the staff assimilation of the IRT work, a description of which can be found here, link, or B, propose something better that can be implemented, and then if it doesn't reach, the council doesn't reach consensus, it will move forward with consideration of URS. But I didn't see questions.
When I read the letter and looking at it right now, this is John Evans, I think the key question for this group is not to answer those 8 specific questions. The key issue for this group is to see whether we could help the GNSO Council reach consensus on the 2 proposals. So A, you know, approve the staff model or propose an alternative that's better on both. And as guidance, we could look at some of these questions that have been raised by some folks in the community, the board, but I don't think it would be fruitful or efficient to go through an exercise of trying to answer those 8 questions.
I was going to say, what we did in our constituency was basically do brainstorming, and we're just drafting up a final proposal. That's what we did. We took the 2 solutions, and we said, what are our comments on both of them, and that's pretty much it. The questions are basically guidance, and that's it. We won't sort of box ourselves within that. That's at least what our constituency thought.
My sense, you know, from just talking to board members and asking them what they meant was they want us to fix it, come up with something we all agree on.
Yeah, I agree that I think there have been enough answers to these 8 questions that answering them again won't advance the cause at all.
David, that's probably true for most of them. Some of them are new, though. You know, the first one saying, will this have a chilling effect, I don't think is one that really has been considered, not that I've heard of, and apparently the board is very worried about this. So We may need at some point to go back and try to answer those questions, but I don't think they're going to help us come to closure on a new solution.
Well, chilling effect was discussed extensively at the panel meeting.
so that there may be ways to, given that it's been raised as an issue and it's seen by people as an issue, there may be ways to help fix it, minimize, and then, you know, keeping that issue in mind, not to minimize the chilling effect, but as you said, discussed extensively yesterday.
Any other suggestions?
So, you know, to Alan's point, what's the process we're going to follow for this group? Are we going to break into two subgroups or not? Are we going to any suggestions for process?
Well, I've given a short time period. As I understand, November the 4th, I believe, is next Wednesday. And by that time, we are required to have drafts from each constituency. I don't think it would be very practical to divide up the group except the way it is divided, the members of each constituency who should develop their respective positions and get them in by Wednesday, and then we'll, this gives us really a day or so to consider them and put, then each constituency has the obligation to put them in final form by Friday. If anyone disagree with that, I'm entirely open to suggestion, but it's knowing Jeff's and Mike and Chuck's constituency, we're going to have a pretty tough time getting it done even by Wednesday. Maybe other stakeholder groups are better disciplined than ours.
Given that it's a day or two of flying between now and then.
Yeah, plus the factor of travel time.
I kind of like your idea of being more informal. I mean, I don't know. What are people thinking? That it has to be a formal letter, or can we submit bullet points?
I think any format that works is going to do the job. I don't think it needs to follow the formal requirements of the comments, statements of constituency and public proceedings. There's just not enough time. We have an enormous job to do in a very short time.
I can tell you categorically that registrars won't have a formal statement in the next 6 or 5 days. This is just a process. But so instead of spending the time, we'll do that. But to Chuck's point, the role of this group is not to get constituency statements. That's up to the constituents or the stakeholder groups. Let's start rolling up our sleeves and talking about the substance of the two proposals and seeing where we could reach some kind of consensus if we can.
Right now.
That's the process that I would be looking for us to do, whether today or, and how are we going to do that going forward?
Okay. Well, yeah, I agree that that's the ultimate goal.
I'd say this is Mark Partridge. I was looking the other day at the recent posting that the staff did comparing the IRT on these with their proposal on these two points as a chart. You have that chart? And I found that format to be very helpful in identifying the points of difference and the places of agreement. And I would think that if we could work toward preparing something like that where we can see what the constituency, we could even perhaps work from this and supplement it on where do the constituencies lie on each of these points, we might find that we only end up with a few specific points of difference that we could discuss, and it would be apparent from this analysis. And I do think that if we are more specific on points rather than just generally expressing a view of, well, overall I don't like this or I do like this, it will be more productive to focus on specific elements of these proposals. This gives us a framework to work with.
David, I realize I was not using correct terminology. I'm so accustomed to saying constituency. The fact is that the GNSO motion calls for the stakeholder groups to file their respective statements, and excuse my having said constituency previously. Now there is a difference. One question about that chart, which I agree is very useful. The last one I saw, it's labeled draft, but it's October 20, and I believe that's the final. That's all there. There's nothing more recent than that. Okay.
Yeah, there hasn't been any changes to that initial document.
Okay.
This is Margie.
Although, just on my quick review, not completely comprehensive, and we're really starting, and lots of new ideas have thrown out at the panel and the last few days in the hallways. There's a lot of stuff in play. So, again, the document we have before us is that, and then all of this kind of everything that's happened here.
Why don't we do a brainstorm session now? Let's just go clearinghouse. What are the issues we still need to resolve? Just throw it out there. Get a bulleted list. This way it'll guide what we can come back with in a week or whenever to answer.
Now that's a question we could answer by next week.
We have to do what the council has asked, which is stakeholder group position statement.
Let's clarify that issue again. This is John. I think what Chuck said and what I certainly agree with is that this group does not have to worry about constituency statements. We have to worry about reaching consensus. The stakeholder groups, however, the stakeholder groups themselves are subject to GNSO motion that says the stakeholder group should endeavor to provide stakeholder group statements or constituency statements in the next week or whatever it is.
So I think we're not in disagreement. It's just a question of terminology. It's true. It's the stakeholder group which specifically delivers their initial position statement on November 4. But I think we as representatives under paragraph 1 of the various stakeholder groups, we in this room have to do it, have to make sure it gets done. But it's not the function of the group itself.
I'm not representing any of the stakeholder group. I'm not voting. So for me, this position is clear. I think this group is, you know, really to brainstorm and to do things around the items.
That's fine. Go ahead.
As the person, I think, who suggested the idea in the Saturday meeting, the intent was to try to get on the table so all of us understood what the issues and problems were from the other people on the group, and we explicitly at that point said, if it comes from the stakeholder group, fine. In the case of the commercial one, if it came from the three constituencies, fine. It was really a matter of assimilating the information so we knew what we had to work on and where there was commonality. My gut feeling is if we choose to do it a different way, which doesn't involve those statements by next Wednesday, I don't think anyone cares. It wasn't done as a formal delivery of statements from stakeholder group constituencies. It was a way of kickstarting the process.
It's 35 minutes into this whole process. I'm just thinking that, you know, a lot of us have had backdoor discussions, back channel discussions. I think it's time to get here together, start off. I would just simply suggest, okay, IP Clearinghouse, John, you're right, IP Clearinghouse, one, what's everyone's issues, where can we find consensus, see if we can move it really quickly. We can't find consensus, we'll put it off to later, but at least try and move on as quickly as possible, because I don't think we're going to get a chance to have this face-to-face meeting again.
I'm afraid you're right.
This is Robin. We're a little bit concerned about going too deep into the substance today because we don't have our fourth member with us, Wendy Seltzer. She's currently in the board meeting and has been pretty busy with all the board activities all week. And so I feel like it's a little preliminary for us to say, you know, from our constituency without having her input. And we don't get that until tomorrow, realistically.
Okay. Well, this has been, as you can tell, meeting is being conducted very informally, and no one is going to be nailed down to positions and opinions expressed in this room.
A
as long as we can, you know, maybe add some issues along the way, I think we should.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
Before we proceed, I do have a question. In the motion yesterday, the at-large was reduced from one person to from two people to one person plus an alternate. I would ask that the alternate be allowed to speak if we're going to start talking about substance today.
And objection.
If that doesn't have any untoward problems.
I hear no objection. But do you want to start with the clearinghouse or the URS clearinghouse? The first, nonetheless.
This is Leslie. May I share the information with all friends here? About 1 month ago, and I have met the Icon Policy Department staff, and they said they prefer a single centralized worldwide trademark clearinghouse than the regional clearinghouse. But yesterday, I have got some information from Kurt Price. They said the regional clearinghouse, in fact, is possible because they just won't have the centralized database. And whether the trademark is valid, the domain name is valid, can be judged by the regional committee. So I think about the clearinghouse, we should focus on the criteria of the which domain name should be judged be valid, and also the regional clearinghouse composition. We should focus the two problems. Thank you.
Thank you.
Andre, questions about the regional clearinghouse. Definitely, I'm experienced with the local Russian law and regulations and trademark protection. In regards to this, I did some calculation statistics. We have about 36,000 trademark records in the database, which is Rospatent, the government state organization. And, the most of the trademarks protected in the Cyrillic script. So maybe we should also consider to a little bit divide this, trademark thing as per script. Because, there are some, Latin scripts, Cyrillic, Chinese scripts. If we maybe we can minimize the whole impact, the whole, pressure for the trademark protection, not only by, regions, but also by scripts.
Okay, so ICANN staff proposed something that's different than what the IRC was, but they proposed separating the clearinghouse into two different functions. First one was the validation function, and the second one is the database. Can I assume that those who want multiple clearinghouses really only care about the validation function and not about the database?
That's exactly right, because with earlier proposals, there was a single one. Both functions were concentrated in one, and the issue was multiple databases. But now that there's a single, exactly. The idea is regional verification, something that brings it closer to the Asian trademark law and mark law, and everybody submits data to one database. The registries interact with one database.
Okay, so that's good. I think we're all on the same page that the registry interacts with one database. I think that's progress. Now, I was going to ask you.
Yeah, can I suggest that we call it, Olivier Crapin-Leblanc, can I suggest that we call the database a repository or a database?
Instead of calling it an IP clearinghouse or trademark clearinghouse, we call it IP stroke whatever trademark database, just so that people are clear as to what we're talking about, because it confuses people sometimes. I know, Jeff, I was on this.
You can call it whatever you want to call it. I'm just trying to get the concept out. So we'll figure out names later. So now comes my question. So if the role of the clearinghouse, help me understand this, because we've done sunrises for years. Okay, this is not a new concept. We've done validation for years. It's not a new concept. We've never had this concept of multiple clearinghouses in different scripts or in different regions, ever. It's never been done that way. and I don't believe there's ever been a recorded problem. If you have to produce a registration, which is a physical document or an online record, where someone can go and validate it, whether it's with the Russian Trademark Office, and forgive me, that might not be the name of it. thanks. Sorry, this is Jeff speaking. So if that's never been a problem before and we're trying to come up with a solution now, I still think having multiple sources in different regions, different scripts, which has never been an issue before, is going to make it a very difficult time going forward with a new round of TLDs in the next, well, I don't know when they're delaying it, so, so maybe not. But in theory, in the second half of next year. So maybe if you guys can help me understand why all of a sudden now it's an issue when it wasn't before.
IDN.
Can I suggest?
IDN.
Kathy Kleiman, can I suggest that we have pegged an issue of difference, and that maybe that this is an area where the discussion is only really beginning, and that this would be a great area for the chair to pick sometime next week for people to present or supporting groups to present ideas, background, really kind of clarify what they're thinking, why they're thinking it, and in the case of those of us who are presenting it, why the new document, the staff document, really opens up new opportunities. We're just at the beginning of this issue. Rather than debating it here, I think, you know, if we're kind of an up or down, clear of consensus or not, this is one for we can mark for exploration.
Okay. I'd like to back up just a bit. I'm not entirely sure that John and I are in violent agreement about the way this group is to function. And I am operating strictly from the GNSO motion. Creates a review team. Each of the stakeholder groups then presents initial positions and final positions by November 6th. Those position statements are summarized by staff and distributed back to this team, and then we evaluate whether there is consensus or whether we can develop consensus. Is that the way other people understand this? Okay. Go ahead, John.
I think you're right, that's what it says, but some of us are also probably going to be helping to write our constituency stakeholder group statements. It'll really help me to know what the issues are, because that's what I'm going to focus on, at least with the registries. That's what I will focus on.
Agreed.
Yes, I think we can discuss the issues, but not really go into them and start debating about them. So we can inform all the other constituencies what are the issues that we want to address.
All right. Do we want to give a deadline of, say, Tuesday or Monday to identify the issues? I'm really at a loss as to how this is going to get done, even in draft, by Wednesday, speaking for the stakeholder group that I come from. I mean, we have 45 minutes here. Are we supposed to get out of here at 6 or 6:30? 6:30. Okay.
Speaking for the registrars, we will not do that. We will not. We want to discuss the issues first, understand what the issues are, take it back to the stakeholder group, and then make an opinion based on that. And if the council motion is not consistent with that, we don't care.
I second that. With regard to the BC, we second that. I think we're wasting, I'm sorry, but with due deference to everybody, I think we're wasting precious time that we have. I know that the NCSG has to go back. I don't think we need to have an agreement on everything today, but let's get into it. I don't think there are that many issues. I've had conversations with the NCSG. I've had it with ALAC. I mean, I think we've got broad agreement on many issues. Let's jump into it. Okay, regional stuff, we pegged it. Let's go on to the next one. That's what I'd suggest.
Okay, that's fine. I'm game. Who's next?
Just to outline a few issues that have come up in discussion before,
First of all, there's a semantic issue that focuses on the idea of validating rights versus authenticating data. It's not, well, that's something that gets debated. And ultimately, it's not really a point of controversy, but I guess it's an issue. Or about it to frame it if you want. But there's three structural issues that go on with the clearinghouse. The first, we've identified that the importance of a single database to lower cost. That's the ultimate goal, is to lower cost all around. The second structural issue is to have a database that's adaptable to the needs of registries as they go forward with their particular plans, so that if they need that data, it's there, and if a future registry needs the same data, it's still there. It doesn't need to be duplicated. Another structural issue is how it gets used, and those are the things that have been raised for use have been watch notices, IP claims process, sunrise process, and a block that shifts the burden of justifying the application in the case of globally protected marks. That's one of the uses was there is an issue that some of the that the clearinghouse could be used for globally protected marks to shift the burden on applications that are triggered by those.
This
is
it an issue that's before this group? I'm not convinced that it is.
It's outside
the scope of the letter from.
Well, the globally protected mark issue was part of the clearinghouse.
Well, but it's also as from what we're looking at, what we're charged with reviewing. As I understand it, it's not an issue that we can take up as part of the function of this group. Any other thoughts on that?
The issue, I think, is whether or not there's consensus. And what we're doing is we're comparing, in essence, what the IRT proposed with what the staff proposed and understanding the differences. And then we're also then taking a look at what the staff proposed and determining whether or not there is consensus. And so I think it's a little bit early to take any one issue off the table. The globally protected marks list was part of the IRT proposal. And if it is an issue that needs to be discussed, we should put it down on the list of things that we need to discuss, and certainly we don't discuss it substantively today. But I think it's dangerous to start listing ideas that are taboo, and if we're going to do that, then maybe we should. I just don't think that we should necessarily need to go down that path today, since the globally protected marks list was part of the original IRT report on clearinghouse.
Can I just say, I think we pretty much know, everybody on the table, that the GPM is going to blow this whole thing up for the moment. We're not going to get agreement on it. I think, yes, if any one of us wants to discuss it, let's put it on the board again and saying we're going to discuss it later. We know we're not going to achieve any consensus right now. Let's put it on the site, move on to the next point.
I'm just trying to go through a list of issues that I've seen identified. These were issues that were discussed at the program yesterday.
Okay.
That was the list of issues arising around structural issues involving use of the data. And the final one that I had is a legal issue that's raised by the staff report, which is the treatment of common law rights. And there's a principle that was stated in the IRT report that was discussed yesterday, but the issue is that the clearinghouse should not be used in a way that creates any or changes any existing rights. That's an issue that is raised by the staff report. I think it's a point that we can all agree on, but it's an issue.
It's definitely one of the points that's at issue. I can't read
the screen down there, but I gather that all of the points that are being raised are being captured, at least informally, so that we'll have a record after this meeting. Good.
David, regarding globally protected marks, as I understand it, our base that we're starting from is the staff proposal, which did not have globally protected marks. Now, it's fair game for everyone around this table to demand that it be put back in, or one or two parties to say it needs to be put back in, but it's not a matter of is it taken out. It's, we're starting with the staff proposal, which doesn't have it today, as I understand. So yeah, it's on the table, and that anyone can say it's missing, and we just really need it.
Yeah, this is Jeff. I agree. There were a lot of things that, you know, multiple clearinghouses wasn't in the staff report. That was rejected in the staff report. But that doesn't mean it's not an issue. I view GPML in the same thing, right? It's not in the staff report. It's something, it's an issue that we need to address, pro or con.
Okay. Next.
The definition of match or identical is different. I think that's an important one.
Any comment on that?
Can you repeat that? What did you say?
Sorry, I said the definition of match or identical.
For the clearinghouse?
For the clearinghouse.
Okay.
In the IRT report is different from the one that is in the staff report. In my view on that is that the staff report is very ambiguous if you see the language in that. And so maybe we need to sort of be more specific. That's my concern.
We probably should list out, there were eight items identified by ICANN staff in a clearinghouse. I want to make sure we capture all those as well. Calling it a clearinghouse versus an IP clearinghouse versus a trademark clearinghouse. Some of these we might already have, but I'll just read them off if that's okay.
You're inserting all these as issues now to be discussed?
Yeah, I think so. Do you disagree?
Only if there are things you want back into the process. Just because they exist as a difference doesn't necessarily mean I suggest that you put them back in if you want them back in.
Yeah, I would suggest that we list them out, and if there's consensus that the change is great, then that these, we can go through them real quick.
I did hear statements made by a certain group that they did not like the change IP to trademark, that it was too limiting. So it's an issue. I think that one is still an issue.
This is going to say, I think the point of this issue list right now is to help, for example, the registry and registrar community, where I said you don't know what to respond to. So this gives you something to respond to.
That's right. So go ahead.
Okay. So we have the name. The second one they listed was whether holders would grant a license to ICANN to use the data, and ICANN would sublicense that right to the clearinghouse. So ICANN license, I guess I would call that data. Third one was GPML, which we have. Fourth one was information clearinghouse repository to interact with URS.
Say that again.
The interaction between the clearinghouse and the URS.
Oh.
Fifth one is one provider performing both validation and the clearinghouse we talked about. Contract length between ICANN and the provider. IRT had recommended 5 years, and the staff proposal was no term specified.
I think the issues a little bit in that one is related to how ICANN interacts with the clearinghouse, whether it's an accreditation type process or whether it's a strict subcontract, or maybe that's not the right term, but a strict contract between ICANN and the provider. So in other words, is the relationship more like ICANN now deals with WIPO, which is just kind of an accreditation or approval of a provider, or is it more like ICANN deals with the registries? Is it a contract? I think that was pointed out in the staff report, and so the issue is which one should it be? Should ICANN have more control into it or less?
Makes 7 was whether specific standards for acceptance into the clearinghouse should be specified or not. The IRT didn't have them specified, and the staff one didn't.
Sorry, I can't type that fast.
The last one was... Okay.
Sorry.
Last one is the clearinghouse will validate any registered mark issuing from a jurisdiction that conducts substantive review. So the...
Mark validation.
So, David, you're reading from the October 20 summary?
I am.
The chart, okay.
And it's John Evitt. Thank you.
I got it.
Okay, next.
On the issue of validation based upon substantive review, I think that we have to be aware that what we're talking about is making a judgment, right, of which country's laws and processes are good enough, in our opinion, and those that aren't. So say, for example, the substantive review that is done in the United States takes a look at the trademark based upon both absolute grounds, which is it a trademark, does it function as a trademark, is it a generic term, or is it a descriptor, or is it arbitrary? And also then compares it on relative grounds against other things that happen to be in the registry or other applied for marks. And so this two-pronged process. Benelux is a very different process. China has a very different process. And so in terms of position, I don't know that ours is fully formed at this point, but I do want to point out that if we get into that sort of discussion, we will be making substantive decisions about which countries we think are good enough and which ones aren't.
So are you saying it's a question of expertise, whether the clearinghouse has the expertise to make that judgment call, or are you saying that it should be?
I think that it's
the ICANN that makes the decision.
Well, no, I think that it's really a qualitative decision. In essence, what you're saying is, okay, we think that the United States is one of the more strict examining countries. We like their processes better, so we will consider those rights to be valid, but we don't particularly care for Benelux's sort of speedy registration process. We don't think they do a good enough job. So if you happen to have a Benelux registration, you're just out of luck.
Following up on that, and on my comments yesterday, I'll put forward that the use of the there's actually a URF definition now in the new URF of a valid registration. This is a definition inserting into the staff report a definition for a federal registration being, because the staff report's ambiguous, it's ambiguous as to, so first recommending that it be a federal registration and that it be issued by a jurisdiction by a national jurisdiction which conducts substantive examination of trademark applications prior to registration. I think I'm following up on your point, Paul, but with some specific language.
I promise to move off this. When we say federal, we mean national.
Yes.
And when we say substantive, we don't mean examined on relative grounds, but rather that there is, in fact, a trademark examiner somewhere who says, yes, that's a trademark. You know, it's not a generic term. It's capable of origin significance.
And compared it against other trademarks already in the database.
Okay, so it is both on absolute grounds, meaning it is capable of being a trademark, and it's reviewed on relative grounds as well. I'm comparing it, not only is it a mark, but I'm comparing it against what else is on the registry. And I want to impress this point. For example, the community trademark system, which covers all the countries of the EU, they don't do the second part. And so if we're going to say, in essence, that a community trademark registration isn't a right that would be recognized in this database, that's an important point to a lot of people. And so we have to sort of determine with some specificity what we mean here. because we may be inadvertently taking out giant chunks of trademark rights all around the globe, quite on accident.
So, Paul, can you repeat what that final point is that you want me to put on? I don't understand. What's the two-pronged processes that you're mentioning?
There are in some jurisdictions, there is a two-pronged process for examination. The first prong is what is known as examination based upon absolute. Okay, so in essence, the examiner is looking at the mark, and they say, is this or is this not a term that's capable of trademark significance? So if I apply for hammers, cover hammers, that will be considered generic and won't be considered a mark. If I apply for craftsmen to cover hammers, that will be considered capable of trademark significance, and so that will pass sort of the first part. The second prong of examination in certain countries is a comparison on relative grounds, absolute grounds and relative grounds. Relative grounds is where the examiner looks at the mark and compares it to what else happens to be already registered in the database or applied for in the database, and they say, okay, nobody else has applied for or registered anything that's confusingly similar to Craftsman, so it passes relative grounds. Okay, and so that's a two-pronged process. However, that's a very British notion, and you see it in, I'm not sure you see it actually in Britain anymore, but you do see it in the United States, you see it in Canada. You don't necessarily see it in other jurisdictions, and the biggest jurisdiction is the regional community trademarks mark, where they only look at it on absolute grounds, and they say, that's a trademark, we're now going to add it to the registry database, and if anybody doesn't like it, they can oppose. And so they shift the burden on anybody else who doesn't like it to be watching what's going into the registry and then for them to file their opposition within a certain amount of time. So in essence, the examiner in that jurisdiction is no longer looking out for the public. They're looking at the thing and saying, okay, that looks to me like a trademark, off it goes. And so if we say, in essence, that we are going to insist on the United States two-prong process, we will be affording protections to people in the United States and Canada and Australia, and we will, in effect, be taking away the ability for people to put their marks in the database from the other jurisdictions that don't have the second prong. So I'm not saying yes or no that that's a good thing to do. I'm just saying that we don't want to accidentally take out entire continents.
And I wanted to follow up on a point. You said you only want, or you're thinking it's only a national registration, so a state or province registration is not included?
What's that, Mark?
Right now we're just identifying the issue.
Right, yeah. Kathy suggested that it only be national marks and that state and provincial marks, I assume by being a national market, state and provincial marks wouldn't be considered. I don't know that we have a position on that today. But it is.
Is that an issue?
Yes, it's an issue. How controversial? I don't know.
I think we flagged an issue for discussion on all the variations, and this is going to be fertile ground, but I don't think I want to debate it right here. I was suggesting substantive examination. We've got something coming back. I think we should talk about it. The ICANN staff report is vague, so we get to define it one way or the other, and I think we can do it.
All right, keep going.
Okay.
More
next.
Common law marks. We think they should be out of the clearinghouse. This
not
is,
on the list?
Is it already on the list?
Yep.
Okay, great.
Okay, next.
Olivier, we are wondering whether we should have a threshold on the multiple national marks. In other words, consider a global mark as requiring registration in N number of countries before being considered a global mark.
Does that mean before being considered for entry into the trademark clearinghouse?
Correct, yes.
I'm sorry, just trying to understand. Are you saying that in order to get into the trademark database or house, it needs to have X number of registrations in a certain number of countries?
Yeah, that's what we're asking. But that's an open issue. It's just a question. It's up to us to answer it.
So if we're going to comment on that, can you just explain why it's an issue?
Sorry, I didn't mention it. Okay, wrong word. It's just a question that needs to be answered, whether we're okay with it or not okay with it.
But is there some rationale to why it's like when someone raised it?
Okay, the rationale behind it is to say if we're going to afford preference of one trademark over another, or if there is going to be preference, then there needs to be a mechanism so as to know which of the trademarks has precedence over another, if there is going to be such an issue. If there isn't going to be any, then, of course, that point is moot.
I understand the question, but the way it's set up, it's not designed that the clearinghouse makes any decision preferring trademarks or data, one set of data over another set of data.
Well, we might then have already got an answer for the question that I asked.
So is it an issue?
It sounds to me like a non-issue. Okay, next issue. Has chilling effect been put on the list?
No. The idea of specifying or providing clear required language or guidance, let me phrase it more generally, language or guidance, to help protect the registrant, to help inform the registrant both of what rights might exist and what rights they might have.
Can I broaden that a little? Just
please.
Say language of the notice in the IP claim process. That's the issue.
Be discussed and be...
Right, I was just coming up with the broad category, right? What is the language in the IP claim process?
And how can it be... How can it be set out to minimize chilling effects?
Minimizing chilling effects
right.
is the goal.
Yes.
Okay. Next issue.
I want to make up the clearinghouse. We just talked about the trademark, about usually the English trademark. How about the internationalized domain name, such as the different language? The trademark's meaning is different. We should consider about the characteristics of the different language.
Let me see if I can revise, if I might. Are we talking about setting out how the trademark clearinghouse will handle multiple languages, but also handle multiple trademark processes, multiple trademarks that may have very, very different categories of goods and services and very different classifications? I think this is a valid point.
Can you repeat that?
Okay. I'm at least familiar with American and EU trademarks and the international classification system. This is going to become very important. What are the goods and services that are, if someone flashes a notice, to know what the goods and services are of the trademark that's coming in. So who's claiming the right and for what goods and services?
Is that subsumed in the last question of what is the language of the IP claim notice and how can it minimize chilling effects? Subsumed in that?
No.
Actually, I think this might end up being a non-issue if I could just sort of. I think once you get the window open up on the IP claims notice.
Don't pollution. Don't
okay.
pollution a registry. Just come up with the issue.
All right. With the window.
It may be a window. It may be something completely different.
Okay.
Yeah.
Neutral. A neutral on that. The IP claim notice. Would provide the name of the different trademarks that actually have matched with the one that the registrant is trying to register. And I would have thought that you could actually click on that trademark and you could actually see, so the registrant can see what that trademark is. You could actually go in and see what the details of the registered trademark are.
So whether you click or whether you see it.
Whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
You would get
so,
to it.
Sorry, so in my mind, because I've done this service before, in my mind that was all subsumed in the notice, because when the IP claim process was done, All of that was in the notes. You want to make sure that...
You were from the Chinese trademark, and was there a way that the registrant could understand the category of goods and services in the Chinese?
It asked the international class, and then it gave... And then it asked for... I don't want a solution here. It's what information do you want the prospective registrant to get? That's ultimately the overall question. What information is important for the prospective registrant to get?
That is an excellent question. I'm not sure that's the one that's being raised.
This is the question that's being asked. How do we give a notice that makes sense to the end user of that notice? Or is the question, how do we account for the fact that the meaning of the marks? How do we convey the meaning of the marks?
It's most about the meaning. You know, give the example of Chinese language. Because the Chinese history and the cultural sector, so usually the English, one English word is can explain to two different Chinese characters. Dot white and dot night, and they can translate in Chinese is the same meaning. And also the organization translate into the Chinese can to two different Chinese words. So usually the local language experts can understand how to judge which the trademark English trademark translation is can be considered
of match versus identical.
I don't think we want to. The idea was to go to that extent and go beyond exact match. From where I come from, if you have it in your own language, then you have that IDN language trademark. So you have a certificate saying, in this language, this is the trademark that you're doing. You don't do meanings in a different text. So if the script is different, that's not necessarily going to come up as a match, I think, at least from what we've seen in the definitions of either the staff report or the IRC.
Or whatever. Or what did registration actually.
So we're back to the definition of match or identical and the nature of the match. Consider translations, I guess, or meaning. Consider. Okay.
Next, explain some other points because, the common laws, the rules, the principles of the trademark judgment is usually we just focus on the regional similarity. But in Chinese trademark laws, they also consider the meaning similarity.
And we'll provide additional information on that.
Well, listening to this, maybe I'm being overly simplistic. It seems to me that you really turn this into a non-issue by saying that you furnish to the inquirer, whoever it may be, the exact details of the registration in the language of the registration, and that's it. And everything else is...
To the extent those rights may block someone or may be shown to someone who doesn't speak that language is from a different country.
Well, but we can't undertake to translate... everything into English, Urdu,
well,
Russian.
We're going to expand this. Can we put a place? First, this relates to the regional clearinghouses, and second, it relates to the meaning and match, and we'll expand on this further.
So do you want, would anyone find it helpful, not today, but at some point, if I were to explain what the IP claim process and Sunrise processes are and how a registry actually implements them? Because they're really, if I could do that at some point, you'll see that meaning is not really relevant.
What's that?
It might help at some point.
If
you might take some of these legal issues and make them non-issues.
If you can produce an email on that subject by tomorrow for everybody, that'll be very helpful. Thank you.
Zahid. And thank you for offering.
Won't be an email. It'll have to be a call.
I would tend to agree with what is being said. So if you're a trademark applicant, register to the whatever. Anyway, and you're trying to put the trademark in there, you provide a certificate of your country. You can say it's Chinese or Urdu in Pakistan. You give that in, it gets validated. Yes, this is actually coming from that country. It goes into the system. If it's IDN, it gets, you know, it'll match with an IDN, but it won't match with a sort of a Latin character. It won't do that. And you cannot, I don't think you can extend it to oral, meaning, or visual, as such. So I think that much is hopefully off the table. I mean, that's not what we're discussing. Flag it.
No, that would be great to put in a statement clarifying that.
Right.
So there's no ambiguity to anyone's
name. Absolutely. I think that's good. And I think just take up the point you mentioned. I think what you're saying is if I send a registrant of a domain name and I get that information in IP claim notice, then I would, if it's in Chinese or some other language, I wouldn't understand it, so I don't know what to do with it. And so you're talking about the chilling effect of that. Well, from what I saw in a IP claims data house, somebody showed it to me. I mentioned that to you yesterday, Jeff. You actually had the classification, the international classification code there. So I guess you could have probably looked at it, but I don't know.
Going back to the original question, does every country in the world, every trademark office, use the international classification code? And if they don't, then there may need to be some kind of translation mechanism. Not translation, not in terms of language, but in terms of differences.
Okay, so
I think we need to think about this one. Thank you. And you're
Can we identify any other issues?
David? Robert's got it.
David, we've got 10 minutes left. Should we move to the URS?
Oh, that'd be a good idea. Move to the URS.
This is Mark Partridge. These are issues that came out of the program yesterday and discussions surrounding it, and some were identified by the staff as well. But first of all, the issue of whether it's mandatory or a best practice. Again, if you want more detail, I can add, but I think everyone understands that one. Second, the nature of whether there is a review upon default. There's a point of view, this is an issue, there's a point of view that was expressed yesterday that if there's a default, it should just automatically result in a decision.
Mark, how is it?
That was one of the comments made at the president. I'm just saying it's an issue.
Okay, so what is it, whether there's a review after default?
Yeah.
Is that the issue?
Mark, what is the staff report's on that?
Staff report's position, and this is the IRT's position, that there is a substantive review in the event of an answer or default. The next one is the length of the timing of the notice. The staff report is 14 days with an option for a 7-day extension. The WIPO's proposal is for UDRP is 20 days. The IRT proposal was 14 days. The related issue is the means of notice. Staff report is fax, email, and snail mail. Another issue that was raised yesterday is the nature of the remedy. The staff report and the IRT report is remedy is suspension, not a process for seeking. That the remedy of transfer should be
Yeah, on that, there was actually an interesting comment that we should think about. We didn't think about it in the IRT, and I don't think it's been thought of. Someone had said, what if it's suspended for 90 days, and if nobody makes a claim to it or no one appeals it, then it's transferred? It was interesting. So I would love to pull it up. I don't know who said
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that was Mike.
Whatever, someone said it. It was an interesting theory. I think that's something to think about.
Next issue.
What is there to be more specific? I just said suspension versus transfer. Do you want me to be more specific?
Yeah, then someone had raised the argument that you suspend it for a period of time, giving the registrant an opportunity to appeal. And if they don't in that whatever period of time, then it's transferred if the trademark owner wants it.
Yes.
Can I try to flesh that out? Because that was a consistent position, actually. The idea is that if there's a successful URS, then successful URS will not lead to just suspension, but after 9 days from the time of appeal, you can actually get it transferred to yourself, or you can flag it, in which case if it goes back into the pool, then you'll get a notice.
Issue. Next issue is the length of the suspension. The staff report and the IRT report had the extension lasting for the life of the registration. WIPO pointed out that, as a practical matter, that often would be a very short period of time.
So it's the length of the suspension?
Suspension, life of registration. And another issue that is comes up, and I guess it's really a non-issue, but it is the issue is that there is a misunderstanding about the nature of the initial freeze, which has no effect on use. Initial freeze is only a formal has effect on transferring or his record, but there's still misunderstanding about that, and I suppose we should address that.
You explain that last one a little bit.
Yeah,
I don't follow that.
I still hear lots of comments that the use of freeze within the report suggests to many people that what happens as soon as the complaint is filed is that the website disappears. It's frozen. It disappears. That's not what the IRT report proposes. That's not what the staff report proposes. But that's still a misunderstanding that's being expressed based on the language of the report.
Oh, okay, thanks. That's it for my list. Thank you. Sahid?
Yeah, I've been reprimanded over email that I didn't raise a point on the IP clearing house that our constituents wanted in. Is the possibility of an IP claim service not just pre-launch but post-launch also? Sorry, Jeff.
Oh. So this is for IP clearing house? Okay, wait, hold on. Wait. So it's okay. So say it again. It's the use of the IP clearinghouse after launch. That's the issue.
Any other URS issues?
Absolutely. We've discussed it frequently that this is a proceeding that is for egregious conduct. We'd like to see a definition of egregious conduct. And elements added to the complaint so that the complainant shows that they are bringing a case to the URS that rises to the level of egregious conduct so that this is a signal both to the complainant where they should go, to the URS or to the UDRP, and that this should be part of the elements in the definition.
Yeah, I'd like to ask a question. The my understanding is that the IRT's proposal used the term egregious really as an underlying basis for a new procedure that would be, in effect, a summary procedure with an assumption that most of the usage of the URS would be in default cases. That if there is a substantive argument about what is egregious, what's bad faith, the rights, the mark, and so on, then you'd almost automatically have to go to the UDRP. And I'm wondering, do we want to get into this?
Yes.
Okay.
We are putting
okay.
on the, and the reason why is, as posited yesterday in my comments, this is a rapid takedown process, which we believe the vast majority of registrants, particularly the non-commercial, smaller school board, community group, individual registrants, will not know about until takedown. They won't know until the day their email doesn't get to them or the website won't resolve. This is what I posited yesterday as the position of NCUC. And so we would like to see a process. If the justification for this process is egregious conduct, let's make that part of the elements of the complaint.
I can tell you that certainly wasn't the intent of the recommendation. Egregious wasn't, I don't even know if the word was in the RIT report. It may have been, it may not have been. But that certainly wasn't the intent of those of us on the committee that reviewed that issue. It wasn't an egregious conduct. The conduct had to hit the elements, but it had to hit. We had to show clear and convincing evidence of that. So it was a higher burden of proof for the same standards. But we could talk about it. It's on the list, and let's have an offline conversation. I know what the timeline is.
Well, we're putting it in as part of the elements, not just the burden of proof, but the elements of the judgment.
Sorry, you said it yesterday, and it was good. There's a standard of review, and then there's a burden of proof.
And the only difference appears here to be the burden of proof, but it should be the standard of review. Thanks for bringing me back to this. Mark, we can argue the points, but I'd like to say I didn't argue yours, so I'd love to go down my checklist. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well,
I think your issue breaks down into several points, which is the elements of the claim, one issue, the burden of proof is an issue, and the procedural standard is an issue. That is, the elements are what do you have to allege in the complaint? What fits the funnel? So elements of the claim is an issue. Second one is the burden of proof. I think ultimately probably everybody seems to agree with that, but it's probably worth addressing. The burden of proof that was suggested by the IRT and the staff is clear and convincing. And then the final evidence. And then the final one is the procedural burden, which is... We were suggesting in the IRT report a standard that's similar to a summary judgment standard. That is, there's no contestable issue. I think David was putting it on the idea of a default. If the person has a substantive justification for what they're doing, it's a contestable issue. And that is an issue because it's not in the staff report. The staff report had the clear and convincing. So I just suggest just breaking down those are issues that are related as a package to what you're saying.
In the interest of the harmony of this group, I accept that friendly amendment because I think that's a brilliant way to break it down and think about it. And for the procedural, now that we have a new term for it, so we suggest different elements of the claim, evaluation of the burden of proof in light of those. Thank you. This is a great format. And for procedural standing, we'll suggest an injunctive standard, one where you prove some sort of clear and imminent harm.
Okay, we've arrived at 6:30, and unfortunately, I have to leave very shortly.
Can we finish our list quickly?
Yeah, is there something to add?
There's more.
Well, go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Do it.
We'll do it. I'll run down the same list I gave yesterday, and then I believe Dr. Comedis has a few more to add. We would like to put forward that we'll be providing additional detail on notice. I don't want to give all the details here, but... better, different types of notice, expanding the notice for registrants. Not quite sure where this fits in, but the assumption of innocence and good faith, that this is not an accuse-you-lose process. And a substantive evaluation has already been raised, a substantive evaluation, even in case of default.
It's two very short comments. Our ideal position would be a review of the UDRP. However, we realize that this is not feasible, so it would be we would like to ask whether we can set a sunrise for the URS and reopen, in sunset, sorry, for the URS and reopen the debate to amend the UDRP at some point. And also to state that, you know, some issues may come later because we're still waiting to hear from our other person. Thank you.
Oh, and of course, the de novo review, based on kind of the IRT, the unringing of the bell.
Sorry, what's de novo?
Standard of review and an appeal.
Okay. And make it a full de novo, especially if there's a default and someone's woken up to the fact that they've lost control of their domain name.
Sorry, quick question so I understand the sunset. All right, so what you're saying is that you implement URS until you can have a full review of the UDRP. Once that's revised in a new version, you get rid of the URS.
We review the URS and see, you know, we can incorporate it within the UDRP, the system can stay. But, yes, in essence, that's what we need.
Okay.
Fees is one thing that I don't think I see on the list. What do you think? Philip, what do you think? Sanctions for abusive filings? Is that what you think? Philip? Yeah, that's something we definitely spent a lot of time on.
Okay. Can I ask a question? Would you guys mind if we had someone else from staff, preferably Kurt's team, that's going to eventually put this into, I mean, at least listen, because I think it would be better if whoever on Kurt's team eventually writes whatever we're going to do is listens in on some of those discussions so they understand when they get the letter and or the consensus. Is that something that anyone would you know, think is a good idea? Because I think that's...
You guys decide who you want to staff it with, and obviously okay. I think that's a great idea. The person who is going to implement it or write it up should.
Yeah.
I mean,
Why would we want that person to understand what we're saying?
You're right.
Just so we get it as correct as possible once there is a consensus.
Yes. The procedures always we should give the procedure justice. So usually we just stand in the position of the trademark owners. But now I think we should also standing in the position of the domain name registrants procedure. We should give the domain name registrants opportunity to defend when there is complaints by the trademark owners. So usually according to the WIPO's arbitration cases, when usually the domain name and trademark disputes, they always punish the domain name holders with the malicious intention. And so if the registrants defend for their registration is unintended, is for non-commercial, it's not for profit, We should give them the opportunity to state their real purpose of the registration.
This is David. I'm very sorry. I have people waiting for me, so I have to leave. But one question that's been raised is setting up a teleconference. I'll ask John to get set that in motion, if that's possible. I think we'll need a doodle to get a time, considering the international.
Right. Arjun, who's the staff person assigned for, like, that kind of stuff? Is it?
You mean
like administrative services, you know, like setting up calls and...
It's Glenn, yeah. Glenn. I mean, Glenn will do it the GNSO way, so
okay.
Glenn or Gisela will do it.
Okay. So, and thank you, David. Do we want to do weekly calls twice a week. I'm just throwing it out there. We have an aggressive timeline.
You laugh, but that's all the IRT. We did every day.
Yeah. I mean, do we want to do it, have one day for URS, one day for IP Clearinghouse? I think that probably makes sense. But, okay, so we'll set up two doodle calls. Glad Adrian's not in the room. Yeah. So one for the URS, one for Clearinghouse. And we'll have to do it sometime in the next week. Next week, right?
So the deadline for the doodle might be at least Monday.
We'll send it out tomorrow. We'll get it set up tomorrow, but doodle anyways.
Yeah, just a lot of people will be traveling, so, you know, we have to give them at least 2-3 days to respond to the doodle.
So can I just make in sort of a point? I think it's been good to get all the issues onto the list. But in order to really thrash them out, I think conference calls are one way to do it, but there should be face-to-face meetings or something. I mean, I know we've got a short time scale, but, you know, the IRT had that ability. We were able to meet face-to-face. But if this timeline is going to be extended, if it is, then we should be able to meet and thrash them out. I think conference calls aren't going to be the complete answer here for issues that are on the table.
Any comments on that, face-to-face?
Yeah, has anyone heard anything about ICANN support for that type of effort?
I'll check into it. And this is obviously an important initiative of ours, so, yeah, I'll check. What city would make the most sense given our composition?
Vegas.
I'll propose California.
Yeah, actually, why don't if we could ask staff to do a poll in addition to the doodle poll of geographic locations of all the members, and we could get a sense of where people are coming from. Okay. Any other issues
for the doodle? If it goes out tomorrow morning or early tomorrow, I'd say the target is by the time staff get into work on Monday, they should have all the answers so they can be done first thing Monday. That if it's sent out tomorrow morning, the doodle, the answer should be in by the time staff gets into work on Monday morning. So that really says Friday, Saturday, Sunday. No one's traveling that long.
So we have a very significant football
schedule. Yeah, I'll email
it. Football schedule Saturday and Sunday. So.
Okay, so Margie will circulate
intermission.
The list. And any other comments before we close? Not, all right, thank you, everyone.
May we continue the good humor, please? May we continue the good humor?
Okay.